Hey, Kelsey, we gotta record another commercial. It's that time of year.
Can we just reuse the one from last year, you think?
Well, we can't because, like, Giving Tuesday's on a different day this year.
Just change the date.
Oh, yeah. Good call. Okay. Hey, Kelsey. We do a lot of work here at the Video Game History Foundation, traveling to meet old game developers, maintaining our library, and making cool content. But how do we pay for all this?
Well, Frank, we're a publicly funded charity. All of the work that we do is made possible through generous donations from video game fans all around the world.
Hey, that sounds just like our listeners. From Giving Tuesday, November 29th through the end of this year, we'll be fundraising to help make the work we do possible. Our generous sponsors are even matching donations dollar for dollar, so your impact is doubled.
So head on over to gamehistory.org/donate and give what you can. Every dollar helps.
Let's save video game history together. Okay, back to the show. I don't think we need to do another take.
No, I think that was good. All right, I'm stopping it. Welcome to episode number 99 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest or two, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And hey, since it's episode 99, let's talk about the Dreamcast, which famously launched on 9/9/99. Get it? To help us out this week, joining us are Tom Charnock and Brian Vines, both from the excellent Dreamcast Junkyard blog. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hello, thank you for having us. It's a great honor.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to have you here. So, you know, this is an episode that we didn't really prepare much for because it's like, look, we got the experts on. Let's just kind of figure out what they want to talk about. And we were talking before the show, and I think a really good conversation that we came up with that makes a lot of sense for episode 99 is talking about the launch. Now, we have, as listeners know, had a show that was briefly about launching the Dreamcast. But what will make this one, I think, kind of unique is that we have two guests here who experienced very different launches. So Brian, of course, you experienced the US launch, and Tom, you experienced the European launch, and so we're going to kind of go through what those two were like and how they differed and stuff like that. So I guess my first question to both of you, I don't know, honestly, I didn't look this up, was 9/9/99 the date in both regions?
No, that's not correct at all. I don't know if I should.
It was supposed to be, though.
It certainly was. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, let's talk about that.
Can blame British Telecom.
Indeed. Yeah. As I'm sure you and all the listeners are aware, 9/9/99, very important date in the lifespan of the Dreamcast. Sear into the minds of many gamers over in the States. The Dreamcast was due to launch simultaneously in Europe. That was then pushed back to the 23rd of September. And then on the eve of that launch, it was pushed back again another 3 weeks to the, was it the 14th of October? And as Brian correctly alluded to there, the reasons for that are numerous and contested, but the main culprit really is an organization called BT, British Telecom, who were a major telecommunications company in the UK and Europe, who were instrumental in the building of the online infrastructure for the Dreamcast in this part of the world. And the actual reasons are not very clear as to why it was pushed back, but one of them is that the infrastructure wasn't ready yet. And the other is that there was some issue with translations, getting all of the documentation translated into all the different languages. Which one of those is true is kind of contested, and you know, depending on which source you kind of look at, will give you a different story. But those are the sort of two main reasons for the pushback of the launch in the European market.
How, I mean, this seems like pretty last minute to change it from, you know, 9-9 to then just like a couple weeks later and then a couple weeks later after that. I mean, what, tell us a little bit about like what that was like. Like, what was the communication for that as it was happening? I mean, you know, surely they were still doing pre-orders in Europe and stuff, and people like were ready to take off work on that day and everything. And then all of a sudden they have it changed kind of last minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest indicators about how unexpected the pushback was is the fact that a lot of the magazines that were coming out at the time were gearing up for, you know, this kind of worldwide 9999 launch, then had to apologize to readers because the first issues came out in kind of August, in you know, waiting for the September release. And then in the September issues were kind of like, oh, in the news section, by the way, the Dreamcast has been pushed back again for these slightly vague reasons. So we're going to review all the launch games anyway, but you can't actually buy the console or any of the games in the shops. So I remember that I got my first Dreamcast. It was about a month after the launch. So it would have been in around mid to late November of 99. But I can very clearly remember the fact that it had been pushed back, and there was this kind of fanfare that then kind of, it was like an empty kind of vacuum. You know, where is it? Where's the console and why? And obviously Sega kind of pointed the finger at BT, and BT kind of went, well, you know, we're trying to make it the best we can. So, yeah, obviously back then it was all magazine-based. That's where we got the information from. So it was a case of the system didn't appear on shelves. Nobody kind of knew why. And it was only when the magazines came out or the specialist press reported on it that us gamers kind of knew that it wasn't coming when it should have done. It was only 3 weeks, essentially, but, you know, it's still, people were a little bit disappointed, as you can imagine.
Well, yeah, and Tom, I would imagine as someone, you know, who is reading video game magazines in Europe in 1999, that you are someone who kept up on games at least vaguely, right? Like you bought magazines, so it just kind of, I don't know. I feel like if I'm in your shoes, it's like, well, of course it's late, right? Because like, because like at that time, Europe got everything later, if at all, for the most part, right?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I was in a slightly privileged position in that I had played quite extensively on a Japanese Dreamcast that a friend of mine owned and imported about a year prior to the US and European launches. So I was quite au fait with the system already, and I was waiting for it quite patiently. I could have gone down the same route and imported one, but I wanted to save myself to get the full experience of the, you know, the, what do you call it, the you know, the full fat English language version of the games that I could fully experience and appreciate. So yeah, there was some annoyance, shall we say. But I mean, I kind of overdosed a little bit on getting all of this information of the US launch. You know, it wasn't alien to me that this system was coming and the games looked amazing and I wanted it now. But unfortunately, I wasn't actually in a position to get the system anyway on launch day because I still had a Nintendo 64. And my mother was dead against me letting me have two systems because she had a very dim view of computer games or video games or computer games, as she called them. So I had to get rid of my Nintendo 64 anyway before I could get my Dreamcast. So I was kind of in that.
My mom did that too.
Mothers have a lot to answer for.
And that's why Kelsey has a wall of games behind
that. Yep, that's it. So I do want to back up a little bit, and we didn't really mention this before the show, but I'm sure we can talk a little bit about the Japanese launch first, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is far prior to the system coming out in both the States and in Europe. So can we just set the stage a little bit with what the Japanese launch was like for the system?
Yeah, Brian, I've spoken far too much and you've been very patient, so I'm going to let you have a bit of the airtime now if you'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a question of where do you start and how far back you go, because literally...
All the way to the SG-1000.
Basically, practically, right? Or at least the 32X or Sega CD. And a lot of that is the Dreamcast itself and gearing up for the Japanese launch, I mean, you have Sega Japan, who was very intent on fixing a lot of the wrongs and basically building on top of the lessons that they had to learn the hard way over the last several generations at that point. Granted, the Saturn was relatively more successful in Japan, but they did understand that that area of growth and for their next console to succeed, which it kind of had to, it really needed to appeal to Western audiences as well. In Japan, I feel like having a big launch was maybe less of a focus. And so their goal, specifically, I think, Shoichiro Iramajiri, who is president of Sega of Japan at the time, I mean, he was very intent on getting a head start on PlayStation 2. They knew that was coming. I think they had it slated for like 1999, which wasn't far off. It ultimately came out in like early 2000, March 2000. But they wanted to just get the Dreamcast out the door. They wanted to build that install base right away. And so they did. But and I think it came out in November 98. And it released with four games. And it was not a particularly, what we would consider a very impressive lineup by any means. Virtua Fighter 3 TB probably had the highest attach rate of any game, so that clearly had some appeal for Japanese players. But otherwise, I think you had July, which was a visual novel to some extent. You had Godzilla Generations, which I can't vouch for. I mean, that is not a very good game. Pen Triathlon, and that was really it. And so they didn't really have a broad wealth of titles to appeal to everybody. And then on top of that, they had production issues. I think they were only able to ship about half of the consoles that they had allotted to, or that they intended to for the Japanese launch. So that in itself stymied a lot of the potential there. And then on top of that, finally, there was just a lot of delays with the games that they had counted on trickling out at least consistently following launch. I mean, I think Sonic Adventure didn't come out until December. Blue Stinger was pushed in so much as that was a killer app anyway. That was pushed until...
it had good screen. It looked good in stills. Come on.
It really did. Yeah. And I will say it is my favorite launch game in hindsight. We can talk about, get into
Sonic
that later.
Adventure. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And so you had all these high profile games. You had Geist Force, which was kind of a Star Fox clone. That was canceled outright. That would have been the only other Sega of America developed game that would have come out near the Japanese launch. I think it was slated for like 2 weeks later, but they canceled that. There's a story behind that we can get into. But yeah, so there's just a lot of things that didn't go quite according to plan with the Japanese
launch. As it is, I don't think we're going to derail this conversation with the history of Geist Force, of all things, but
I just looked it up and it's dumped. So
well, like a demo sort of it. I don't. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, the prototype is.
Yeah, yeah. It got further than that, but oh, we're derailing now. See, I just said we're not going to derail and talk about Geist Force. Now we're talking about the state of the image that is online and how it's actually just an early prototype and not the finished game. And the game was probably pretty finished anyway. so, okay, that's sort of how it went in Japan. But Brian, were you like Tom? Paying attention to the Dreamcast here in the good old USA as it was getting ready to launch?
I was. I think around the time of the November 98 Japanese launch, I saw the November issue of EGM, which had Sonic the Hedgehog on the cover. Now, granted, to this point, I was kind of had a cursory interest in newer video games. I grew up with Sonic the Hedgehog, Mega Man, Super Mario Brothers, but I like kind of took a break for a while. So I was not privy to what was happening with Nintendo 64, PlayStation, that whole fifth generation Saturn.
So was this your first time seeing 3D?
Yeah, effectively. I mean, it was my first, other than maybe like, I don't know, Virtua Racing or whatever I would play in an arcade, right? That was my connection to Sega at the time, was knowing, Virtual On and playing Sega Rally. Like that was where that interest garnered from. So when I saw those games kind of come out, or at least like Virtua Fighter 3TB was going to be announced. But really it was that Sonic Adventure. And seeing Sonic just full cartoon, pointed fingers, just stylized on the issue on the cover of that EGM, I just picked it up immediately. I was like, whoa, okay, I grew up with Sonic. I could get behind this. And then looking through just page after page of bull shots that they had showing him and his friends all in these, you know, these intricate exotic locations. I'm just like, oh my God, this is blowing my mind. I mean, I'm going from, yeah, from my understanding of games as, you know, primarily 2D interactions with just these broad worlds that I could only imagine how sophisticated or large or dense they might be. And so that really did capture my imagination. And from that point, I subscribed to EGM. I subscribed to everything I could, really. And I have to thank my mom in hindsight for putting up with all of that. But yeah, it's probably all I am.
Throw something away to sacrifice for the Dreamcast.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, she even bought me a Nintendo 64 that Christmas. So I was like, wow, okay, thanks for the support, guys. This is great. Although I think my dad played Star Fox 64 more than I did, so it wasn't really just for me, I gotta imagine. Anyway, that was a little bit all over the place, but yeah, that's suffice to say, I was really honed in on the Dreamcast launch, and I was poring over every game and every announcement that would come up leading to 9999.
I mean, I wasn't planning on this, but I my story is sort of similar, so I kind of feel like interjecting myself into this narrative here, which yeah, is that. So much like Brian, I don't know that I've met anyone else who has the same story. After the 16-bit era, I just stopped playing video games. Like I completely missed PlayStation and 64 Saturn era. I didn't have a computer either. I just wasn't playing games. I was just being a high school kid with a guitar or whatever. And I'm not going to say that like seeing the Dreamcast like reawakened the gamer inside of me or whatever, but what did get me back into games was when the Dreamcast failed very soon after launch, and you could pick it up for $50 used and then go to Best Buy and get a stack of $5 games. That's what made me get into video games again. So, I mean, it's, I don't know, like it's kind of interesting how the Dreamcast, you know, was our onboarding back into the world of video games, but from completely different reasons and time periods.
And that's where the name Dreamcast Junkyard comes from.
It's actually quite true, to be honest.
Oh, really? Is it?
Yeah, tell us.
Like bargain bins?
Yeah, so I had my original Dreamcast from the you know, just after launch all the way up until it would have been around about the end of 2001. And then I made the error of trading everything in that I'd collected for a PlayStation 2 and one game, which was NHL 2002 from EA Sports, and one memory card. So yeah, I was quite happy with that. I was like, yes, this is now the future of gaming. You know, Dreamcast Junkyard wasn't a thing. Nobody really cared about the Dreamcast. It was sort of seen as this flagging, ailing system that nobody wanted anymore. So I got rid of it, got my PlayStation 2. And then a couple of years later, I was waiting for a bus, of all things, and I was stood opposite a game shop, and in the window was a Dreamcast. This would have been around about mid-2005, and it was ridiculously cheap. It was something like £20 with about five games, and I thought, oh, I remember my Dreamcast. I wonder if there's any, you know, there's any other games that I haven't played on it. So I went into the shop, I bought the Dreamcast, took it home, and I was kind of reintroduced to it, you know, three or four years later. And it was through buying that system in that shop on that day that my mind was kind of reintroduced to it. And I kind of went down this rabbit hole of trying to find all the new games that I'd never experienced the first time I had a Dreamcast. eBay was quite in its infancy at the time. So you could jump on eBay, you could find Dreamcast games for like literally pounds, pence, some of them. Video game shops were selling the games, you know, dirt cheap. You could get there was one particular shop called Game Station, of quite a big chain in the UK, and they had this offer where you could buy one game for £4.99 and you'd get another one free. So you could essentially get two games for, you know, essentially $5, £5. So I just kind of went around on this sort of tour of the northwest of England where I lived at the time, to all the different cities, like to Liverpool, Manchester, all these other places, trying to find game shops that were selling Dreamcast games cheap and just buying up all the ones that I'd played previously and ones that I'd never even heard of. And so began the Dreamcast Junkyard. I decided to start blogging my adventures. It was literally just for my own entertainment, essentially, just something to do. So I'd write blogs about getting on the bus, and it was quite sort of, you know...
2005 era internet blog.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was looking for, yeah. So it was, you know, I went on the bus to this town. I went and found this game. Here's my thoughts on this game. And that's essentially where the Dreamcast Junkyard started. The name comes from my housemate at the time, who commented that there were so many packages coming from eBay day after day that my room in this shared house was turning into a junkyard of Dreamcast stuff, and hence the name for the blog was born. So housemate Tom, if you're listening to this, you know, thanks for that. That was your doing. But yeah, just to go back to the original point, essentially rebuying old games that I haven't previously played is where the blog started. So yeah, and here we are, 17 years later. My maths is terrible. So yeah.
I have a silly question, but the, you know, $5 or £5 game thing that made me think of it. Here in the US, I think even kind of literally still, you can buy one specific Dreamcast game, Coaster Works, for like $5 sealed. Really? And it has never not been a $5 sealed game. Is there one of those in the UK as well?
There is indeed. It's Choo Choo Rocket, believe it or not. Well, there's two actually.
Oh, that's
there's
such a good Rocket, game though.
And there's Toy Racer. I believe Toy Racer was a PAL exclusive. And basically, up until maybe a few years ago, you could get it literally for a pound or 50 pence. And it was one of those games that people would buy because they could use the boxes as donor boxes. Mm-hmm. So you'd find, you know, copies of Toy Racer on eBay with no case. It was just the disc and the booklet, because somebody bought it to get the case to replace the horrible PAL Dreamcast cases, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little while. But Choo Choo Rocket and Toy Racer.
Those cases probably are such a pain. We can just use whatever generic CD cases here. But the cool European ones with the, like, they're just really nice feeling. It's kind of like, I don't know, like they have like a really thick blue spine, and it looks nice and feels nice, but also probably a huge pain in the butt if you're trying to collect them, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's not so much the fact that they don't look nice. I mean, I do think they look quite aesthetically pleasing. The one thing that kind of sticks out to me is the fact that the Pantone color of the blue of the Dreamcast PAL cases is completely randomized. They're not all uniform. So if you've got a stack of blue Dreencast games,
oh, they're like different Pantone
different colors. Yeah,
that's not like sun fading or anything. That's like they literally came in different blue. Oh, that would drive me nuts. Oh
yeah,
my God.
Yeah. There is an anecdote that I heard, and I can't remember where I heard it from, that there was no standard color
there was no official Dreamcast blue that was just provided, like, by Sega.
Estimated it every time.
I mean, that could be completely false, but that's an anecdote I've heard. And just to go back to the cases themselves, the reason that maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, talking about the differences in the packaging, but the reason I believe that the Dreamcast cases in Europe look like they do is because they needed to be big enough to accommodate a manual which had multiple languages in them. That doesn't really give it a pass for the horrendous, fragile hinges that snap just as you look at them.
Sega's really good at making horrendous, fragile hinges on their cases. That's like the Sega staple right there.
Of course, yeah. And of course, on top of that, you've got the spindle inside where you put the disc. They'll snap off just by breathing on them. So you've got discs which will shuffle around inside the box and get scratched, and then the hinges where they'll just snap off, and you've got the front that just literally lifts off in your hand. It's just awful. So any PAL Dreamcast collectors who are listening to this will know exactly the pain of which I speak.
So Brian, I want to go back to you. So Tom had this experience where he got it when it was new. He enjoyed it for a while. He sold it, got rid of it, moved on with his life, and then became a freak later. So how about you? Was it love at first sight and you never let go, or did you kind of stray for a while and read it? Like, how did you go from just being a fan getting this to being, you know, part of this, you know, online project, or were you always just kind of like this?
Maybe a little bit of both. I mean, you know, I don't think there's ever been a point in my life where I've only played Dreamcast and only like been laser focused on that and that alone. I've always kind of appreciated it within the broader, I guess, tapestry of what else was going on of the era, particularly early 3D era, as developers were still figuring out how to make their games just function on a basic level, mechanically, systemically, technically, whatever. I think Dreamcast stuck with me though, because there were so many experiences on it that felt like they, I guess, redefined how I looked at the medium. And so prior to that, all the games I played were centered around very limited verbs of, you know, action, jumping, fighting, shooting, you know, whatever that was. And I would look at games coming out for the Dreamcast that were like Seaman, where you're talking to a manfish, or some of the rhythm games it had, or something like Rez later on, which was also a rhythmic, you know, Tatsuya Mitsuguchi's studio had developed in tandem with Space Channel 5, actually. He had all-nighters to do both of those.
The but one you're not mentioning that drew me was Shenmue, right? Like, there wasn't really... Yeah. You know, that wasn't a type of game that I don't know if it is, you know, now still kind of there's sort of indie-ish stuff with that same sort of maybe tone and cadence and speed. Right. But at the time, like that was a very unique game that just kind of it almost felt like a statement on what games could be. Now, granted, games could be a lot better than Shenmue, it turns out, but like at the time, like it was a very unique proposition to have this slow contemplative game where, I mean, for me it was, you know, going in the kitchen, opening a drawer and looking at the silverware, right? That's mm-hmm. That's not a thing that you did in video. Like it wasn't, and it wasn't like, you know, you might have an adventure game in the past where, I don't know, you can hover like your eyeball icon over the silverware and he goes like, oh, the knives are getting dull. But you know what I mean? This is just like, just for the sake of showing that this is just an ordinary life, you know, like this game allowed you to open a drawer and look at silverware and he doesn't even comment on it or anything. It's just something that's in a drawer. And, that felt very unique to how I think of the system, even like the Dreamcast is the home for weird stuff like that.
Absolutely. I mean, Shenmue is the mother of all examples here, and not only does it let you do those things, they don't really serve a broader purpose in the game loop most of the time. Right. It is exploration and, you know, really just leveraging the player's curiosity for its own sake. And seeing games that did that was really just like, oh, this is not a world that I'm conquering. It's a place I'm inhabiting. I can be a virtual tourist here. And that's always been, certainly with Shenmue is a number one example there. A game that really got me to think like, maybe games, I can connect with games on a different level than just trying to, you know, be competitive or beat the thing. You know,
it's a triple A game about being bored. I mean, that's
like, why not?
That's what the game's about to me. And that's so weird in retrospect. And let's talk about some other differences. We kind of talked about the packaging. I mean, you mentioned the color blue. I still think it's kind of weird that, you know, it's orange here, blue in Europe. Like, do we know why they decided to change colors?
Yeah, we do know.
Oh yeah.
Should I go
for it? Go for it, Tom.
Yeah. Okay. So there is a German company called Tivola, which was in the business of making PC games at the time of the Dreamcast, and they had an orange swirl, and they threatened Sega with with a lawsuit if they went ahead and released the system in Europe with an orange swirl, because obviously people would confuse the Dreamcast with Tivola that makes edutainment games for the PC. I actually have two of their games. I saw them at, I don't know if you have these in the States. Over in the UK, we have these things called car boot sales. I think it's kind of similar to like a yard sale or something in America.
Yeah, flea market.
So I was literally just rifling through some boxes of junk, and I came across these two old PC games, and I instantly saw the logo, the Tivola logo. I was like, oh my God, I've never seen these in the wild before. I'm going to get them just because they are loosely related, tenuously, to the history of the Dreamcast. I think they were about 50 pence each or something, but I've still got them. I've never tried them just because I don't have a PC that runs Windows 95. But
that swirl is the same swirl. Like, yeah, they're not wrong. That is the same as the Dreamcast swirl.
And they are a video game company. I'm going to give them this one, honestly. Yeah.
It's interesting.
And then Germany responded by not buying any Dreamcasts.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are other companies now in present day that have a very similar looking swirl. There's a company in the UK that sells carpets called Tappy Carpets, and they've got a swirl that looks almost identical to the Dreamcast swirl. But I guess there is no kind of Sega as it existed then to kind of say, oi, that's our logo. You know, you can't use it.
Are these things reported on the blog?
Of course. Yes.
Thank you for keeping the dream of blogs alive in this modern world. We need more of this as our social infrastructure collapses. So that's going to be a very timely reference to exactly when we recorded this.
I do want to talk about one of the other differences, at least as far as I know, between the US and the UK's launch, which is that the US had they launched with a ton of games, more games than I think. I guess I don't know this for sure, but it's a lot for a console launch, more than I think is normal. And that didn't quite happen in the UK. Is that right?
The launch time, I think there were around, was it around 30 in the US?
Probably. Oh, no. It was 19 on launch day, and then
right,
they kind of trickled in after that. I think it was 16 in Europe.
Oh, so okay. Yeah. It's not that big of a difference. Certainly a big difference from Japan, though.
Yes. I was getting my figures mixed up. I was about to say that we got 19 in the UK and you got about 30 in the States, but obviously I'm completely wrong there, so it completely ignored that. But we did. It was quite a healthy launch lineup over in the UK. My first game, incidentally, was a game called Speed Devils, which I bought before I actually got the Dreamcast, because I was so excited to get my Dreamcast. I just wanted to have something that was associated with it. So I bought this game, didn't have the console, and spent about 3 weeks just looking through the manual over and over again at what was to come when I'd finally had the system. So, yeah.
And we have a fun Speed Demons story in the US, right? There's a very rare version of that game that's censored. Brian, you would know more about this than I do.
I actually am not sure. For Speed Doubles specifically?
Well, I probably shouldn't have brought it up, but my vague recollection of it is that I believe it was Walmart demanded a censored cover for it, is a very rare physical version of that game that I'm going to look this up while we talk about other things so I can make sure I don't sound like an idiot here. Yeah. But there was some sort of censorship in the US with that game.
That's really fascinating. I love little nuggets like that. That's really cool. I mean, I've got an equally interesting one. Have you ever heard about the issue with Jet Set Radio? Oh, sorry, Jet Grind Radio, and the City of Milwaukee.
No,
City of Milwaukee tried to sue Sega and stop the release of Jet Grind Radio in the United States because they claimed that it glorified graffiti, and just before the game released in the United States, Milwaukee had spent several million dollars cleaning up large swathes of the city, getting rid of the graffiti off the walls, and they saw Jet Grind Radio as a way of this, making it cool for kids to spray graffiti, and it would all come back again. And I heard a snippet about this in the news section of a magazine at one point in the distant past, and I thought I'd try and find any evidence of this being true. Lo and behold, I dug through the court records in Milwaukee and I found the actual court sort of, you know, the transcript of the case. And it's now been removed from the internet. However, I was I had enough forethought to basically copy and paste the whole thing onto the blog. So as you said earlier on, Frank, about, you know, traditional blogs still have their use for digital preservation.
Oh, yeah.
It's all there on the Dreamcast Junkyard. Yeah, so the City of Milwaukee versus Sega over Jet Grind Radio is a lovely, fascinating little snippet from the history of the Dreamcast. Yeah.
I also can't imagine it helped that Sega leaned into that, right? I think, and maybe Chase covered it when he was on your podcast a while back, but they famously or infamously had, around Jet Set Radio's launch, they had a big competition in San Francisco where they brought in people who would tag or just graffiti artists to have a competition to see who would, you know, win and get a free Dreamcast or something. I don't remember all the details, but like,
it wasn't like an acclaim like contest to have kids go spray paint, take photos, yeah, and the best, you know, like at least it wasn't like that.
They brought in
professional taggers.
Yeah. To claim ignorance, I meant to say. Yeah. It couldn't be like, oh, we didn't know. That's not an issue.
Also, just to update on the Speed Devils thing, they just removed the Satan head from the logo, and that is the Walmart censored variant of Speed Devils on the Dreamcast.
Learning something here, Brian. I didn't know anything about that. Amazing.
I mean, it makes sense at the time and the amount of sway that, mothers would have in getting riled up over satanic imagery. This does not come as a surprise.
Now, I wonder if there's like a Walmart set, because something that comes to mind for me is there is a Walmart exclusive packaging for a Nirvana album where they did not like one of the title tracks. It's on In Utero. You could probably figure it out, folks. And they had it changed. And it is a different song title only on the Walmart version of that album. So I wonder if, like, someone out there must be the Walmart censorship collector. I want to meet this person.
Yeah, does it have to be censorship or can it just be unique packaging? Because there's like a very rare Pokemon Heart Gold and Soul Silver that was a Walmart exclusive packaging.
Well, I think if it says Walmart exclusive, it doesn't count. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it has to be something that was changed to cater to Walmart as opposed to like an incentive that it's an exclusive.
Okay.
It's an interesting topic. I mean, one of our colleagues who writes for the Dreamcast Junkyard and occasionally appears on our podcast, a guy called Mike, he is like an uber collector of all things Dreamcast, you know, absolutely anything with the Dreamcast logo on it. He's either got it or he knows about it. And he has a rather impressive collection of variants. So literally what we're talking about here, you know, you've got Walmart Walmart specific things in Europe. Certain games were released in certain countries with certain languages on the back of the box. Mm-hmm. Only certain Portuguese versions were released, not released in other countries. There were boxed box sets, so special editions of things like Virtua Tennis. Even consoles with pack-in games were released in certain areas of Europe and not in others. And he has got this almost encyclopedic knowledge of that type of thing. And I just wanted to give him a shout out because he's a Dreamcast, you know, he's a walking Dreamcast encyclopedia. And so that kind of thing does exist, certainly in Europe anyway, and South America as well, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, this is getting a little bit off topic from the Dreamcast, but I can tell you from firsthand experience, this is not the kind of thing that's documented very well, is, you know, very minor regional packaging variants. I don't know if you caught me looking behind my shoulder, but behind me is like a case of games that I've worked on. And I had to just kind of scour, you know, every regional auction / you know, resale site just to figure out regional variants of my own game. You know, like I didn't know which ones had, you know, French packaging in Canada, right? Like, yeah, I had to figure that out. And and it was a pain in the butt that like the expensive collector's edition of Legacy Collection had a Canada exclusive. It's like, oh God, I had to buy that again. It's
expensive. You have to. But the law. You have to. If you worked on it, you have to buy the
mod. I have to. No choice. But then, like, you know, one or two SKUs came out in Brazil with like their rating, but nowhere else in South America, as far as I can tell. And it's like, yeah. Again, kind of off topic, but it's like, that is not the kind of like weird international packaging variants for what is the same like game disc inside is not something that is tracked very well, because for the most part, what we preserve is the game data. And if the data is the same, we kind of don't care about the rest.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, some of these variants for the Dreamcast, literally the only difference is the fact that a variant from one country had a sticker on the box, something like that, as you know, meaningless as that. So yeah, it's quite a tricky.
That's the rarest Master System game in the US set is a European Sonic the Hedgehog, but they put a US UPC sticker on it, and that is the only thing that changes it from being a European quote unquote copy to a US copy. So that sticker is the like rarest.
Literally the
thing.
Barcode. The barcode sticker.
Just the barcode.
That barcode sticker is worth hundreds, maybe $1,000 or something at this point. Yeah.
Well, and to bring this back around to maybe be a little bit more about Dreamcast and Dreamcast.
You got us halfway there with Sonic.
Like, yeah, and that's where I'm going with this. Yeah. So, you know, in the US, they did something kind of cool in partnering with, was it Hollywood Video that rented out Dreamcast systems like a month before.
Oh, before it came out. Yeah, I think it was Hollywood. Yeah.
And it was bundled with Sonic Adventure, but this like limited edition of Sonic Adventure that was, as far as I know, only available through this kind of like rental program.
Brian, do you know?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it's possible maybe some retailers had it for demo, but certainly I think that's where I'll have to double check my facts before this episode goes to edit. So I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. We're just quizzing you live on everything. Like the encyclopedia you're supposed to have.
You're the U.S. representative for the Dreamcast.
But I mean, my point with this more is just that, like, this, you know, the U.S. launch was like a pretty big deal, and I'm always struck by some of the promotions they did in the launch. To me, the biggest of which is actually you can play this an entire month early. You can go rent it.
Yeah, that is kind of crazy, isn't it? Like, there's not really been anything like that unless you were, you know, you were importing and they didn't want you to do that. Like, Tom, you had that experience, but unofficially, not Sega licensed. I mean,
no, indeed. Yes. That was me sitting in my friend's bedroom with him playing on an imported Japanese Dreamcast. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned, Kelsey, actually, again, going back to the differences between the launch in the UK, in the US and in Europe. You just touched there briefly on the sort of the promotional side of things. As somebody who kind of viewed it from afar, I was quite intrigued by the difference in the sort of the advertising slogans and the advertising the advertisements that were on TV. So the things like the It's Thinking campaign, which was obviously huge in the United States. I was lucky enough to actually interview the guy who came up with that slogan a few years ago, a guy called Brian Bassino. And he explained how it all came about, where they wanted to make the Dreamcast seem as if it was it's actually alive and it had artificial intelligence and it could learn and adapt to how you played. And I just thought it was that's a really cool way of marketing a system. And compared to the sort of very sort of staid and slightly dull, to me at least, way that Sega Europe went about things, completely different. They tried to market the Dreamcast as more of a lifestyle item at a more mature audience, and they didn't show any footage of any games in the advertisements on TV.
That's such a weird choice.
Yeah, so just by pure contrast, in America, you had these bombastic adverts full of Sega characters and game footage, and in Europe, you had the shave commercial with, like, you know, barbers shaving people's heads, and you had one where you have these kids stood on the shoreline throwing stones at a boy, or a buoy as you call it, in the water. No mention of what it was or the word Sega or anything like that, and it was just like, how bizarre that two strands of the same company have taken such different pathways in trying to promote this system. I found that actually quite fascinating, to be honest. The other thing was that Sega obviously used in Europe the tagline up to 6 billion players to kind of tell people that you could play online. But of course,
up
you couldn't play.
6 billion? Oh, because that's the Earth's population. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. So you couldn't play with people outside of your sort of geolocation. So you couldn't play, people in Europe couldn't play with people in the States, for example. So the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK came down on Sega and said, you can't use that slogan because it's incorrect.
Because you can't act, even if everyone in the world had a Dreamcast, you still can't play it with all 6 billion people.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah.
But it's theoretically, the rest of us could come to Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Set up the world's largest LAN party.
Theoretically, yeah.
I'm sure British Telecom could handle that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, with the It's Thinking campaign and also the 6 billion players, or at least like some of the launch advertising that was from Sega of Europe at the time. I mean, I think both of those you could critique for not really clarifying what the Dreamcast was, that it would, you know, obviously, and I think even, and I think Peter Moore present throughout most of the Dreamcast lifecycle, he had emphasized that they wanted to make it clear that the, you know, that the with online connectivity and everything, he wanted to make it clear that Sega is front and center in the branding. Their early marketing research told them that this would be valuable. This would, you know, that people still saw Sega as cool somewhat. But I mean, through that whole It's Thinking campaign, they kind of failed to tell everybody they were making a new console. And so you really had to, unless you were already paying attention to those episodes or to those issues of EGM, like I was, and people like me at that time, there was a lot of guesswork or a lot of like piecing together what they were talking about. And so, I mean, you could have that critique that it still wasn't explicit enough, maybe in a similar way that Wii U kind of had those issues later on.
There is a school of thought that Sega was so kind of, intent on ridding itself of the sort of the specter of the Sega Saturn and the failure of that system, certainly in Europe, to make any kind of impact whatsoever, they purposely try to ditch the Sega branding. On the European Dreamcast boxes, there's no mention of the word Sega unless you look in the very small print on the side panels.
Oh wow! I had no idea.
Yeah, there's no mention of the word Sega on any of the game boxes. There is a small Sega logo on the front of the console, but that's it. Sega also entered into an advertising shirt sponsorship deal with four soccer teams in Europe, Arsenal, Saint Etienne, Sampdoria, and Deportivo La Coruña in Spain. And they all had the word Dreamcast on their home kits. And you know, even though they did have the Sega brand on the away kits, a lot of people didn't know what Dreamcast was or what it meant. Even people, even now, who I know who support Arsenal, which is an English football team, soccer team, they know that the Dreamcast logo was on the front of their shirts during one of the most prosperous times for their club, but they don't know what a Dreamcast is even now. So, you know, it didn't really work. It almost alienated more people than it did kind of attract them to the brand, because Dreamcast itself wasn't really a known, you know, it wasn't a known force, whereas Sega was. And yeah, it's a whole can of worms, really, that whole thing.
I mean, just thinking back to my personal experience, I barely knew it was coming out. I wasn't paying attention to video games in general, but, you know, I was, I was like 17, 18, something like that. Like, I'm the perfect age.
You've been watching TV, at least.
Right, exactly. Being,
yeah.
And I mean, I knew there was a new Sega system and it had a new Sonic game or whatever, but like I was not properly marketed to, in that I didn't realize. So the way that I first really got exposed to how much more advanced this system was than anything else was walking through a mall and walking by an EB Games, a game store, and they had TV monitors facing out front. And other people have had this experience too. Like, I looked and I was like, why are they broadcasting a football game, like an actual in real life game, mm-hmm. at this video game store right now? And then I did a double take. I was like, oh my God, that's a video game like that. And that should have been conveyed to me by the people trying to sell me the system at some point.
Exactly.
That like this thing is crazy advanced and it's a huge leap. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of remember the It's Thinking campaign. I mean, I have this vague memory. Brian, maybe you can fill me in, or either of you really. Like, wasn't there sort of a, like, inside a human's brain, like the different departments sort of ingesting the Dreamcast? Wasn't that the campaign? Like, I'm the nervous system or whatever?
Yeah, I think in that same, I don't know, Cortex, whatever, where all the Sega right. characters and all the digitized NBA players, Gary Payton, were all partying.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah. It's like, that did not really convey much more to me than there is a video game system and it has games on it.
<You know>? Well, I mean, think about how it worked for us over in Europe. We had these TV adverts with no game footage on them, and just yeah. you know, at the end of it just said like Dreamcast. Somebody watching that be like, well, what's that? And then you had these football kits with Dreamcast written on. And so you were suddenly exposed to this word, but you didn't have any, unless you were like someone like me, who was, you know, already quite kind of involved in the world of reading video game magazines and, you know, what small information there was on the internet as it existed at that time. The average person in the street wasn't going to try and go and find out what it was. It was just, it was, as you say, Frank, it's the job of the promoters and the marketers to tell you. You shouldn't have to go and, you know, dig into, you know, layers of materials to find out what the thing is that they're trying to sell you, you know. So I think it was quite disastrous, really. And I do know that after the initial launch of the Dreamcast in Europe, the advertising company was ditched, and they got a new one in that actually started to show adverts with actual footage in them. Because I'm guessing somebody at Sega on the phone. People don't know what the Dreamcast is, so it's, you know, it was a very successful launch, you know, as far as things go, but it could have been better, I think. So
that is something that I'm kind of, I don't know, the Dreamcast has always confused me a little bit, because it seems like the launch is kind of around the world. I mean, obviously, you know, in Japan there were chip shortages and that sort of thing, but like, around the world, it seemed like Dreamcasts were selling out. They were incredibly popular. There was a ton of hype for it. And then it just, you know, like, this is a console that only lasted a couple of years. And obviously, you know, I mean, I think most people know a lot of the prevailing theories, like piracy killing the system and that sort of thing. But it does, it's always struck me a little bit weird that, like, they really did, for the most part, hit all of their projections and targets for selling systems, and then it just still kind of didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it's the $64 million question. Like, you know, how can a system with such a prestigious company behind it, and it's hit, as you say, Kelsey, it's hitting all the marks. It's got the games, it's got the hardware, it's got the peripherals. It's, you know, it's doing everything that you would want a system to do.
Well, and it's and even yet, hitting the sales numbers that they were projecting. I mean, they're saying like, we're going to sell 1 million by then, and then they're doing it. And
it's interesting. we did an interview with Peter Moore several months ago, and he actually said that, you know, the reason that he was given the task of, you know, picking up the phone and telling people that they were discontinuing the system was that Sega Japan were putting ever more fanciful and unreachable sales targets onto the various arms of Sega around the world. You know, we want this many sales, we want this many sales. And he was just, you know, we're not hitting those targets. And that's where it all kind of fell apart. So from the very strong initial sales that the Dreamcast had, around the world, in every place that it launched, other than Australia, which is a whole different story. Apparently, it was a disaster in Australia. It was very strong, but then, as you know, time went on, and again, it was only a very short window that the Dreamcast was officially supported by Sega. But those things that you mentioned again, Kelsey, came into play. So things like the piracy side of things, the PlayStation 2 was on the horizon. It was a whole series of unfortunate events which kind of led to the Dreamcast's ultimate kind of demise, inverted commas, you know, and it's the great mystery of our gaming times, I suppose. How did such a system fail? I think in Afterlife, it's actually become more popular and more revered than it did at the time it was actually contemporary. You know, that's my experience anyway.
Yeah. And to add on a little bit, I mean, even if Sega had found a way to counter all of those things or mitigate those challenges stacked against them, I mean, they still would have been Sega, right? Like they were still fairly reactive in the way that they were positioning themselves in the market. They, you know, were doubling down at that point on their internal studios. They had restructured all of their R&D divisions to be, or AM studios to be, just their own independent entities. And they gave them a lot of leeway to just make themselves the face of the console with their projects. And a lot of those, like Seaman, like Shenmue, like Space Channel 5, I mean, they weren't necessarily going to bring in sales from audiences that were only had a cursory interest in video games in the way that a lot of Sony and Nintendo's properties would. So, I mean, there was that. And yeah, I mean, I feel like the strategy of them just having been rooted in this arcade legacy and carrying that on with a lot of the projects that they were trying to sell the Dreamcast with. Granted, some of them were successful, like Crazy Taxi, I think, was one of the more, one of the more appealing games on the platform for mass audiences. But like, you know, they just needed to change their identity, basically, that to something that they weren't, right? To really have any sort of shot at countering what the PlayStation 2 was going to, the challenges that was going to pose. Plus, they did not have the support of a lot of third parties that would have filled in those gaps. So EA was notoriously, they weren't producing games for the system. Squaresoft, like, they didn't really have the buy-in of a lot of those popular publishers outside of, like, Capcom. I think they were probably the biggest stalwart of their third party or their third party library. But yeah, there are just a lot of challenges all around in trying to meet the market where they were, I suppose.
So, you know, we're kind of talking about the demise of the Dreamcast, but I think what the junkyard shows, I mean, if you go look at it right now, and you should, at the links in the show notes, folks, go check it out. The sort of aftermarket life of the Dreamcast, I don't know if it's like the most vibrant of any quote unquote dead platform, but it kind of feels like it sometimes. Like there's kind of like always something happening on the Dreamcast. And I don't know how to phrase this as a question other than why.
Great question. Who knows? I mean, I think there's two components to the answer of this question. And the first is that the Dreamcast, for some reason, has kind of transcended, the age that we live in. It came out in, in 1998 originally. It lived a very brief and bright life span until sort of 2001, 2002. But now we're here in 2022 or 2023, and the Dreamcast is still revered to this day. It's still kind of, it's reached this mythical status. And I think that's in part down to the period of time that it actually shone. And that is just on the cusp of the internet becoming a huge thing in people's lives. There's a new generation of people who have been introduced to the Dreamcast who maybe weren't around when it existed in the first iteration. So they're discovering it now. And it's like anything that came from that period of time, the late 90s, early 2000s, there's almost like a sort of a mystique and a fascination around it. You only have to look at videos on YouTube of things that, things like VHS tapes or CD-ROM games. They have this fascination for like a younger audience. And I think the Dreamcast is very much in that mix. The second part, I think, is that the Dreamcast is a console, by all accounts. I'm not a developer, so I can't vouch for this, firsthand, but apparently it's a very easy to develop system. So you've got new games being made for the system even today. This fascination with the system has got a huge community around it of people who are very passionate. We all talk to each other, very close knit, and we just want to celebrate the system, you know, going forward. We don't just want it to be left languishing in the past. And as you say, the Junkyard blog, whenever something new happens in the community, we're just kind of on it, you know, like, you know, let's, you know, this is going to sound really big headed and I hope it doesn't come across that way, but I like to see the Dreamcast Junkyard as the sort of the news outlet for the Dreamcast community. As soon as something new happens, even if we're not directly involved in it, we like to kind of report on it. And yeah, it's great, really. I mean, it's fascinating that a whole new generation of people are getting involved in the scene, in the system. New games are coming out for it all the time. There's old games being discovered all the time that were never released. There's a whole online, you know, side of things that's getting brought back online with DreamPi and Dreamcast Live and Dreamcast Now. So yeah, it's a really interesting time for the Dreamcast. I don't think it's going to slow down anytime soon. You know, there's still new hardware being developed for the thing, you know, so who really could have ever dreamed this would be the, you know, when Peter Moore made that phone call in 2001, you know, we're pulling the plug on the Dreamcast, you know, I'm sure in his wildest dreams, he didn't think that, you know, 20 years later, people would still be playing the thing daily. New releases are coming out. You know, there's a whole fervor around the console even now. So,
yeah, I think that's an especially good point about, you know, just how few years this console was officially in development compared to how long it's lasted. I mean, you know, Frank is always a huge proponent of, like, the NES has never died, which is very true, but also the NES was very successful in its own right, selling it, like, they were still selling NES systems into the 90s, and you could still get your Famicom fixed at, like, the Nintendo repair shops mm-hmm. into, like, the late 2000s, I think. I mean, it's, like, that is a console that sort of earned its staying power, whereas and not to say, you know, that's not like a judgment on the Dreamcast. It's just like, this is staying so long despite the fact that it only lasted a couple of years in the actual, you know, like traditional retail market.
Well, and I think we can't ignore the fact that, ironically, one of the reasons that might have killed it, the fact that you could run unsigned code really easily, might be what kept it alive, right? Like, not commercially for Sega, but, you know, yeah, it's easy to develop for, but it's also easy to manufacture for, right? You literally just burn a CD and you now have a game that will just run on a system. And I think that is what's kept it alive, you know, spiritually for its fans. And you know, Kelsey was kind of mentioning how I like to talk about how the NES just never died. Like, I guess the point that I make with that, and that I think that you all are making with the Junkyard, is just challenging the traditional narrative and not letting corporate interests dictate the story, right? Like, the system's still alive. Just because Sega isn't profiting from it anymore doesn't mean that it's not alive. It just means that it's not profiting Sega anymore. That's all it means.
Yeah, I think a lot of systems, a lot of older systems, classic systems, do have their own online communities that produce new content, new games for them. Even things like the ZX Spectrum or the Amstrad, those kind of systems. For some reason, the Dreamcast one is very vocal and very, very large. And again, very passionate, and there is
and
something
organized. This might be like a credit to the Junkyard specifically, but it's very organized. You know, like, every game feels. I mean, again, comparing to the NES, like, or even the Game Boy, stuff just kind of comes out all the time. But for some reason, it doesn't feel canonical. I don't know, but like the fact that the Dreamcast is all sort of organized and the community is sort of aware of everything coming out for it, it just all feels like one continuous story to me.
Yeah, and there's the new players come into the equation all the time. There's a new publisher, but they're not new, but they're new to the Dreamcast, a new publisher called Wave Game Studios, who are based in the UK, have come out, and they are producing really high-quality, professional-looking indie games for the Dreamcast. So there is a lot of tension. There is a lot of attention on the Dreamcast at the moment. There's more new games coming that we can't really talk about. But there's so much stuff that's out there. If I knew the answer, I wouldn't waffle as much as I do. But it's a combination of different things. As I say, it's the passion, it's the memories, and it's the actual hardware itself. It all lends itself to being a really good melting pot for creativity and just new stuff. That's a technical term.
Well, gosh, I think that's a really great place to end this conversation. Tom, Brian, thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. We will link to the Dreamcast Junkyard in the show notes and anywhere else you'd like us to. But for those listening, where can they find the Dreamcast Junkyard online? What's the URL?
Yeah, so the Dreamcast Junkyard is at www.thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk.
Great. Thank you so much, you guys. This is great.
No, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.